Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, income tax, dividend tax, capital gains tax, inheritance tax. Thresholds all been cut or frozen. But is it time to cut the tax burden and stop dragging ordinary folk into taxes designed for the rich? Simon has his views. Also today, how much have you actually lost to inflation? We do the math so you don't have to, and probably wouldn't want to after you see the results. And would you buy food 2 years past its best before date to save money? We take it for the team and put two new apps to the test again so you don't have to. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, every politician likes to say they're on the side of working Brits. But due to the biggest stealth raids in decades by the government, thousands more nurses, teachers, police officers, all set to lose more of what they earn to tax. A report out this week warns that one in five taxpayers will pay the 40p higher rate by 2027 as a result of the controversial freeze on tax thresholds. That's almost five times the figure in the early 90s. Now, it's not just income tax, but as I said earlier, a host of others, once seen as reserved for the rich, that are hitting ordinary folk. So what to do? Simon Lee, welcome. Firstly, Simon, economics 101, if you would. Fiscal drag?
Fiscal drag doesn't sound amazing, does it? And it isn't. It is, in fact, something of a drag. There you go. Boom, boom. It basically involves not changing tax thresholds as either inflation erodes away the value of people's money, or wages go up, for example, or asset prices rise, so that you drag more people into that tax net. And if we look at the one that is very much in the news at the moment, which is the high rate tax band, the threshold for that kicks in at just above £50,000, at which point you move from paying the basic rate of tax at 20p in the pound to higher rate tax at 40p in the pound. So the next pound that you earn is going to face 40% income tax on it. You'll only see 60p of it. And if you don't raise the threshold, you pull more and more people into that. Now, they will, of course, only pay 20% tax up to that level. However, it does mean that any pay rise that they get, they start to lose more money off. And where it really hits people is when they just go over the threshold, or they're just over the threshold, and all of a sudden they look at their pay rise, which would hopefully just even try to nearly almost keep their wages in line with inflation, which obviously most people's pay rises are not managing to do at the moment, because inflation is a sky high double digit 10.1%. And then they discover that actually 40% of that pay rise has just been eaten up by tax, and they feel slightly unfairly treated, because if inflation is 10%, then in order for the purchasing power of your money to just be maintained, you need the 10% pay rise, and you also need the tax band to move up by 10% as well. Otherwise, you are losing out. So people are facing a double whammy at the moment, because they aren't getting inflation matching pay rises, because, you know, there are very many good economic reasons why when there's an inflation spike, you can't dish out inflation matching pay rises. And also they're finding that tax is eating more of their pay rises as they get dragged into that higher band.
Thank you very much, Simon. Lee Boyce, a report out this week talking about nurses and police and all sorts of people being dragged into this higher rate. Tell me about the report. Who did it? What does it say?
Yeah, so this was from the Institute of Fiscal Studies. And basically, they're saying that by 2027, 2028, more than one in eight nurses, one in six machinists and fitters, one in five electricians, and one in four teachers are set to be higher rate taxpayers. That's because of the freeze in the rate in which you pay that 40%. That's pretty staggering. And to think that one in five are going to be pulled into that net. The big question is £50,000 a worthy amount for a higher tax? You know, it should the level be going higher, basically? I'm surprised that there hasn't been more being kicked off about this, to be quite frank with you, because it's quite outrageous, really. Now, for lots of people who are listening to this, £50,000 is a very decent salary. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that that is not a decent level of money, but I think that there is quite a lot of grumbling at the moment in the British workforce, in which people are just getting quite fed up. They're feeling like they're being taxed to the absolute hilt. And I've seen it myself. I've seen it with friends, people just moving to other places where the tax isn't as high because they feel like they're being unfairly treated. And that £50,000 for that 40% is too low a threshold. So also in this IFS study, they're saying that this will be the biggest single tax increase since VAT was almost doubled to 15% in 1979. I mean, that is, again, another incredible sentence. It's going to raise tens of billions of pounds between now and 2728. Whoever happens to be forming the next government, I'm sure it's going to be one of the big hot political potatoes of next year as to whether or not this freezing should stick around. But it's a tricky one, isn't it? It's a very high level of tax, I would argue, for a figure that has stayed the same, a wage figure that has stayed largely the same. And more people are just getting hooked into it, where one in five. I mean, I don't know how fair that is. And maybe people listening think that is fair. But I mean, that seems like an incredible number of people getting dragged into that rate.
Well, you say, like, why are people not kicking off? Because, you know, maybe the 7 out of 8 nurses that this won't affect, the 80% of plumbers that this won't affect, the 75% of teachers that this won't affect. It's not really nobody wants to talk about the sort of higher rates anymore, do we? Give money to the rich, isn't it? One in five, isn't that many, is it?
But when you delve into the figures here, so for this IFS study saying that by 2728, which is where this freeze is meant to sort of end, 7.8 million people will pay higher rate tax. And that compares to 1.6 million 30 years ago. That's a big jump. That's a big jump in numbers.
Well, that's a crucial point there that Lee makes before we go into the argument for it. And the crucial point is that this was traditionally higher rate tax, a tax band for the rich. It was, you know, it was considered to be a tax band for the rich. And in fact, the IFS study suggests that the tax threshold would have to be almost doubled from just over £50,000 to almost £100,000 to return it to the level that it was initially intended at. So what you're looking at here is two things. One, another example of a tax originally designed for the rich that is now being levied on a much greater proportion of the population. And there are a number of taxes like that, one of which we're going to get onto in a bit, inheritance tax. Secondly, you're also looking at a scenario where there is a degree of intergenerational unfairness. So go back to the early 1990s, go back to, say, for example, people who are now, you know, professionals in their kind of 30s, 40s, their parents' generation were in the similar life position as they are now. Much less of those members of their parents' generation who were living the same lifestyles, earning a similar amount of money, were paying higher rate tax than those people now. And higher rate tax was designed for the very rich. It wasn't designed for plumbers, electricians, nurses, teachers, things like that. And you're then looking at the scenario, of course, where people are paying a far greater multiple of their wages for houses. People don't have the same company-backed pension schemes in the form of defined benefit schemes, usually final salary back in the day. People don't have, you know, various other benefits that generation got. I mean, for example, any of those people hitting the higher rate tax bracket now, if they have children, start to get the child benefit taken off them, which actually increases their marginal tax rate to potentially above 50%. Now, not only if you go back 30 years, were their parents' generation similar earnings, you know, not the same number because the number has changed, but similar earnings, if you work it back for inflation, only paying the basic rate of tax on that and not the higher rate of tax on that for their extra pound, but they were getting child benefit from their children and not having it taken off them. So their marginal rate was increased. And this happens all the way through the tax system. The argument for doing it is that we need money and we don't have enough.
I was going to say, times have changed though, Simon. Times have changed, Lee. Like, we had furlough to get through, COVID. But, we've had all sorts of issues.
And why have times changed so much? Why do we need so much money? Again, there is an example of intergenerational unfairness. Some of it is to do with the very large bill that we have for the health service and for the state pension and the hangover from COVID, much of which is aimed at the older generation. And if you look at, for example, the plan to deal with COVID and the NHS backlog, it involved national insurance. National insurance is something that isn't paid by pensioners. And so that there is an example of intergenerational unfairness going on here. There is an example of a tax that was designed for the rich hitting normal people. And yeah, maybe that's fair enough, but maybe we need to have a more honest conversation about it rather than doing it stealthily. And I think the IFS report is really good because it does go, okay, right, let's have a proper look at this. What is really going on here? And furthermore, I think there's also a point where you can get away with doing this for a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, for some reason, that it's very difficult to work out what that exact reason is. Is it inflation? Is it the political atmosphere? Is it people, the cost of living crisis? Or, you know, all of those things, who knows what it is, but you reach a tipping point. And people suddenly start going, hang on a minute, I'm not happy about this. And you don't realize you're reaching that tipping point until you're past it. And I genuinely think we've gone past that tipping point. And the Conservatives have got a problem here. This is not a political podcast, but you know, they're the people in charge of taxes at the moment in this country. They've got a problem because traditionally what you needed to do to get elected as a Conservative government or remain a Conservative government was two things. You had to be competent. People vote for you because they think you're more competent. There is just this thing where people think the Tories are less likely to do mad stuff than the Labour Party, right? Okay, so competency and low taxes, and because people worry that the Labour Party are going to get in and put their taxes up. The Conservatives have got a real issue here because they've totally blown competency out of the water in the last few years. Nobody's going to be voting Tory because they think that they're getting a nice, firm, stable hand on the tiller. And they've also been raising taxes on everyone for quite a long time now and dragging people in. And this goes back way beyond Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak. Rishi Sunak as Chancellor, Philip Hammond as Chancellor. It goes all the way back to George Osborne as Chancellor. This has been ratcheting up over the years, not just income tax, but a lot of these other taxes. And when it's the Tories are labelled, you know, the party of the rich, well, maybe they are the party of the very rich, but actually when you look at the wealthy, higher earning middle classes, they have been whacked for quite a lot of tax. And so all Keir Starmer has to do is basically look like he's going to be competent and sensible, which is literally his whole shtick. So he's not going to struggle with that one, Captain Boring, and just say he's not going to put up people's taxes. Are we going to get a tax giveaway now in the last couple of years of the government as they desperately try to scrabble to gain favour with people? But more to the point, is it going to be enough? What would you have to do to these taxes to return them to a level where people think they're fair? And to go back to my original point, this is where you start to have an issue, is if you do this for a really long time, fixing it becomes almost impossible. I can't see them doubling the higher rate tax threshold from £50,000 to almost £100,000, can you?
No, not at all. And I also think that anything that might be seen as sort of a gimme to the rich, and I know that we've just discussed this isn't for the rich, after the quasi-Kwarteng disaster, Liz Truss disaster of the 45p issue, I just can't see them touching it. Lee Boyce, your final thoughts on this one?
Well, yeah, I can't see them touching it. I mean, they've only really, it's not been that long since they announced the freezes, and they've somehow kind of trundled away. There's been so much going on, I almost feel like people aren't really seeing the full effects. That's what I think. I think people maybe aren't so aware of this until they sort of land themselves in it and find themselves working up that career ladder and getting themselves nudging over that £50,000 mark. I mean, £50,000, especially in London and the South East, you know, is now the kind of thing that is just getting busted left, right and centre. And I think that it becomes a real, you know, you've got the, as Simon was talking about, the sort of generational divide, then you've got the North and South divide. It's just a lot of moving parts and lots of things to consider. But fundamentally, I think that it's incredibly unfair that it hasn't at least gone up with inflation. Yes, inflation has been incredibly high over the last year. I think when you freeze it like that, I think it's a very unconservative thing to do. And I've been quite surprised by it.
Yep, indeed. Obviously, it's harder, I think, down south, but I've lived all over the country. You tell me that having, I don't have three kids, by the way, but say you're the sole breadwinner with three kids and you're earning £50,000, that is tough. Right, we're going to move on to another tax catching more people in its net, and that is, as Simon alluded to earlier, inheritance tax. It's the most hated of all taxes, apparently, even though relatively few estates actually pay it currently. But again, frozen thresholds and high house prices are making another tax designed for the rich become a headache for more people. Simon, you've been tackling this thorny issue in your column this week. How much of a issue is inheritance tax, really?
That depends on which way you look at the scenario. So, for example, if the question is, how much of an issue is it in terms of, is it catching more people in its net? It's definitely an issue, because the number of people being caught in the inheritance tax net, the number of estates, was up 24% over the past year. And that's going to continue. This has been on the cards for some time. As the wealthiest generation ever to live, those born post Second World War, start to run up against life expectancy. And that starts to lead to large estates, large inheritances being left, which people look at and go, well, that person's going to inherit loads of money. But when you're on the other end of it, somebody who does inherit money, you're rarely absolutely delighted about it, because in many cases it's involved one of your loved ones dying, and you really would probably rather the person was around than the money. So there is a personal element here, but just leaving that to one side, you've got, you know, people dying off who in large chunks of the country are being pushed over the inheritance tax band by a combination of their lifetime savings and of course their property's value. Property that they paid off the mortgage, and house price inflation means has risen, you know, many, many times over the year. And depending on where you are, your house might be enough to just push you over it by itself. And it's not even a mansion. It's just a 4-bedroom, 5-bedroom detached house. You've got a big house. You've got plenty of money. You're wealthy. But those people, do they consider themselves to be super wealthy? Again, we go back to the whole tax originally designed for the very rich, now catching more ordinary people. But then you look at actually how many estates pay it. And even with it having risen 24%, it's only 41,000. So it's really not that many. Now, this is going to continue to increase, but even the ambitious projections only suggest an increase from 1 in 20 estates to 1 in 10 estates. 1 in 10 is quite a lot. The problem is, though, once you go above the inheritance tax threshold, the tax is 40%. And that can start to be a very large sum of money in one go. So everybody has a nil rate band of £325,000. On top of that, they have a £175,000 allowance for their own home. But that's only if they pass it to a direct descendant. If you're a couple, so if you're married or you're civil partners, you can pass on your unused inheritance tax allowance to your spouse or civil partner. So that means that they can effectively double up. So they go from having £325,000 to £750,000, plus the extra bit for their own home takes them up to £1 million. So you could pass on £1 million estate free of tax. Above that, everything is taxed at 40%. Now, there are a number of problems with this. One, that is the system is effectively And there was a report into this in 2018 by the Office of Tax Simplification, which was asked by Philip Hammond to look at inheritance tax and recommend ways to simplify it. The government, of course, has completely failed to act on any of these recommendations in the 5 years since. However, it highlighted quite how bonkers inheritance tax is. So the very wealthiest estates pay a lower rate of effective inheritance tax, because once you get to above about the sort of £4-5 million mark, it starts becoming very much worthwhile to start involving yourself in some reasonably lucrative inheritance tax avoidance schemes. Buying farmland, for example, works. The rich are just better at tax avoidance. The unmarried are penalised compared to those who are married or civil partners. If you own a home with your sibling and you've lived there for 40 years, you are disadvantaged compared to somebody who owns a home with their spouse or their civil partner and has only lived in it for 2 years. It also penalises the childless because they get to pass on less of their estate without inheritance tax because they don't have the direct descendants. And also there are some annual gifting allowances that are wildly out of date. So the rules permit you to give away up to £3,000 per year without risking inheritance tax liability. A rule that was created many, many years ago, that number would be well over £10,000 now if it had been risen in line with inflation. They also allow just £5,000 as a special exemption for a wedding. There will be many people who have got married going, £5,000, I wish. It is possible to have a wedding much cheaper than that. Most weddings cost much more than that. But most people's problem with inheritance tax doesn't even zoom in on those details. It hinges around two things. One, they think this is a tax on money they have already been taxed on. So their argument is, I paid tax on this money when I earned it. Why should it be taxed again when I die? This isn't entirely accurate because, for example, the wealth levied at death includes things like the rising value of assets, such as investments and homes, and that rise in the value hasn't previously been taxed. You might pay tax on the money that you pay, that you earned to pay the mortgage, but you haven't paid tax on the house price gain that's, you know, over the years. But that's not to say there isn't a point. It is true. The earnings that went into the savings accounts, the investments, and buying homes, they were taxed. So was the savings interest, the dividends, the capital gains, all that stuff along the way. Also, the biggest moan is basically the rate, 40%. It's like nearly half. You know, that's how our brains work, nearly half. And so, you know, people really don't like it. And actually, funnily enough, if you read the comments on the stories and if you look at the poll that we did,
yeah,
people really, really don't like inheritance tax and they're very, very vehemently anti it. And I suspect that actually lots of those people, statistically speaking, who are so vehemently anti inheritance tax wouldn't face it.
Mm. It's the principle, though, isn't it? Lee, what were the options? What does the poll say on your website?
What I was going to say, George, I fall firmly in the camp of it will probably never affect me. But as I've said on this podcast numerous times in the past, I'm really not a fan of inheritance tax whatsoever. I think it's a tax on success. And I understand that at the end of the day, you know, passing down vast sums of wealth onto children isn't exactly ideal. But a lot of those people with those big estates end up, as Simon says, avoiding it anyway because they're better at finding ways of doing it, whereas it's more like middle classes that are getting hooked into this because of rising house prices, essentially. So that's why I think it is just a little bit unfair. And I like Simon's idea of a lower rate. I think 20% is a lot more palatable than 40%. So the options we had on our website: if you were Chancellor, what would you do about inheritance tax? And we gave seven options. Okay, number one, the most voted, 48%, 1,299 votes, abolish it altogether. Wow. That's the extreme option. Now, bear in mind, these are our readers. They're
a lot of votes.
Financially, yeah, there's a lot of votes on this. And then 27% raised the threshold. That had 733 votes. 12% cut the 40% rate, was the third most popular option. All the others, the small change gifting rules, it's fair keep it the same, got 2%. Wealthiest should pay the most, squeeze them more, that got 5%, and something else, tell us in the comments, got 2%. I haven't waded through the comments, so I don't know what suggestions are in there.
Well, some might be combining the two cutting the rate and raising the threshold?
Quite possibly. I think abolishing it is probably a little bit too extreme. And that's why I think what Simon's written is really kind of fair and makes a lot of sense. And I think a lot of people dread it. And the thing is, whenever we write about inheritance tax, and these stories fly, people read them, you know, whether it's how to avoid inheritance tax legally, you know, what can you do to strip away your assets before you pass away? It's such a morbid thing. What happens in a lot of circumstances is that relatively successful middle class people end up in this IHT trap. And just kick the can down the road and think, oh, it's morbid thinking about how I'm going to get rid of my wealth before I die. And then they die, and then families left with this 40% bill. I feel really kind of, from the very few people that I've ever known that have been caught up in IHT, is, you know, how unfair it feels that almost half of it has gone. And usually it's not, you know, these are people that are self-made, people that maybe worked up the ladder, owned businesses, done all sorts of things where they feel like they've paid a lot of tax over the years and contributed to the system. And then all of a sudden, here we go, you died, and there's another 40% whack. Now, on the flip side of that, as I said, there's a lot of wealthy people out there, people with large sums of money. And I think that's where a lot of the public think this is who it affects. But the stark reality is now it was another tax that was designed for very richest in Britain that is hooking in middle class people. And yeah. I think that's what is annoying people. And, you know, 1 in 20 at the moment are having to deal with this. If it goes up to 1 in 10 again, it's just tax on tax on tax. How much more can you tax us, Georgie? I've had enough. Abolish all tax.
Don't ask that question, Lee. But yeah, I think my parents are probably quite typical of many people. Not necessarily cash rich, two scientists, but live in the South, house prices have gone through the roof.
Exactly. And I think that's the issue, isn't it? And, you know, it's just really, really difficult one to kind of, I know a story of someone that, you know, came from absolute nothing, really, really kind of dirt poor, set up a business, became a very successful businessman, you know, paid taxes, various members of staff that he took on over the years, all paying tax and systems, paying tax left, right and centre, business rates here, there and everywhere, passes away. And IHT bill, you know, from, is that really wealth being passed down? I don't know. I think what a lot of people think about is they think about kind of more the sort of, as I say, the sort of higher society, you know, the people that are trying to dodge tax with like all these avoidance schemes and this, that and the other. And the stark reality is it could be just Mrs. Moggins, basically, who owns a, you know, 4-bedroom house that she happened to have bought in the 60s and 70s that's now worth a mint. She doesn't even look at it in a kind of monetary value. Yeah. It's more like that's just where she's lived all her life. And then she knows that that's going to have a 40% tax bill when she passes away and it's handed down to family. Mm-hmm. If that's fair, I don't know. Is there a fairer system? I don't know. But I can see why it is one of the most hated taxes.
Simon, what's wealthy anymore? What I mean, if we're going to pick figures for all these taxes, what do we pick?
Well, it's difficult to tell. I mean, if you look at there are statistics that show, you know, what median level of wealth is and then show it by deciles. And so you can pick out a number from that. And they, you know, tend to give you an idea of what counts as wealthy. I don't have them in front of me, so I can't answer the question as to what the numbers are. But I mean, you need to then decide what percentage, I guess, of the population counts as wealthy. Is it the top 10%? Is it the top 25%? Is it anyone above the middle? I don't know. I mean, what I would say about inheritance tax is that it obviously seems a strange thing to be doing, arguing that you should cut it at a time when we need to get as much money in as possible. And we're hitting people heavy in the pocket for income, for example, which people pay, a lot more people pay income tax than pay inheritance tax. However, there is an argument that says if you have a tax that manages to be so unpopular, so irrationally unpopular, despite the fact that so few people actually pay it, that it is potentially undermining people's faith in the tax system, then there is a case for doing something about it, particularly if, as that Office for Tax Simplification report pointed out 5 years ago, the tax take from it, the receipts, only make up about 1% of the UK's entire tax take. So when you look at it that way, you think, is it really worth having this thing? Which is why my argument is, if you're not going to abolish it, then cut the rate, make it 20%, make it a much fairer number. 20% sounds like a much more palatable number. People are totally okay with paying 20% most of the time, apart from VAT, which they get quite grumpy about. And, you know, you go, okay, all right, well, 20%, you know, fine. Make it much simpler. Just have a simple £1 million threshold, 20% above that. Get rid of all the stupid fiddly allowances. Done. Detoxify it. That's my argument. Detoxify it. And there are many countries in the world that don't have any estate taxes. Among them, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Mexico, Hong Kong, Macau. And that bastion of low tax capitalism, Norway.
Right.
You could also do Portugal, Sweden, or Israel. But they probably won't manage to avoid inheritance tax in the UK if you move to those countries, unless you meet quite stringent sets of rules and don't come back here. You can't just, like, you know, nip over there and then nip back, kind of thing.
Right, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Sam, how's the past week been?
Hi, Simon. Yeah, the NASDAQ and S&P 500 are currently the highest they've been since last August. The DAX has made a new all-time high. Of course, we've seen one for France and the UK already this year. So on the face of it, all seems pretty good, pretty fantastic. But when looking for the catalyst this week, it's got quite a few analysts scratching their heads. Some will put it down to the initial overreaction of the debt ceiling drama. So we've had some more positive news on that front, which has sort of sent markets higher a little bit. Others are pushing it down to the overall positive earnings season that we've had, which is now drawing to a close. But in reality, it just feels like the market is following the path of least resistance for now. Volumes across the board are the lowest they've been for quite some time. And in my opinion, we're really going to need a new story to actually send markets considerably higher or considerably lower. What could that be? I mean, maybe a black swan event, but I'm not entirely sure right now. The debt ceiling does seem like a bit of a non-event. Inflation seems under control. I do think the markets are getting a little bit too excited about rate cuts. So any comments around that may be what drives markets. But if that doesn't happen, then I think markets can follow the path of least resistance, despite the seasonality, which would usually kind of have a hold on markets. So for now, I would just be a little bit patient.
And what do we have to look forward to next week?
Yeah, next week's got some interesting data points that market participants will want to keep an eye on. We've got global PMI data at the beginning of the week, which is quite a good economic activity indicator for each country. We've also got the latest UK inflation figure, which is finally set to come below 10% and actually somewhere around 8.2%, according to the consensus from analysts. Elsewhere for the UK, we've also got UK retail sales. So come next Friday, we'll have a slightly better outlook for the UK than we do now. Fingers crossed it will look better than it currently does. From the US, we've got a second GDP reading from quarter one, but usually second readings very rarely move the market. And we've also got another inflation metric that the Fed like to keep an eye on. That comes out next Friday, so that's relatively important too. Earnings-wise, we're pretty much done in the US, but companies like Nvidia, who have had an unbelievable year, they report their earnings. Salesforce and also Costco report next week. So they'll be worth keeping an eye on as we get to the back end of the month.
Thanks very much, Sam. Speak to you next week for another update.
Welcome back. Inflation, it's high. We talk about it a lot. Stuff is expensive at the moment. It's been expensive for a while. But as we've been talking about, house prices have been soaring. Savings rates have peaked at 5%. And many investors will be feeling, well, better off than they did 3 years ago. So how much has it really cost us? Lee, talk to us about Ed's article, would you?
Woo, we can get 5% on our savings. Bad news, inflation still double digit. So you're losing in real terms. But hey, at least it's not 1% and we're facing 10% inflation.
Every cloud, Lee.
Every cloud. So Ed went off and got AJ Bell to crunch some figures for us. I'll give them in two blocks and then we'll talk about them. So basically, since the start of 2020, he asked how things have performed in the monetary value in terms of growth, and then adjusted it for inflation. So, for example, if you put money in a global, if you put 10 grand in a global equity fund, that'd be worth £2,534. That's nominal growth of 25.3%. But when you adjust it for inflation, the actual real rise is 5.2%. And it's actually worth £10,521. So £521 growth, not too bad. Second in the list is property. We've had the property boom since the pandemic, which again, I sometimes just sort of pinch myself and think, what on earth? Like when we were first talking in the pandemic and house price crash predictions, and it's just stayed resilient, hasn't it? I mean, it's quite crazy. But anyway, 24%, that would return to £12,404 on 10 grand. Adjusted for inflation, that's 4.1%. It's actually £10,412. But this is when this is where things get a little bit more bleak. So if you had an instant access savings 1%, which okay, in the last year they've been ticking higher, but 1% was pretty standard for 2020, 2021, and most of 2022, you'd have £10,102 since the start of 2020. Adjusted for inflation, that's minus 15.2%. So that would actually be worth £8,480. And then if you had it just sitting in a current account or something on 0%, obviously that'd still be 10 grand, but it adjusted for inflation, that's minus 16.1%, so £8,394. So if you've kept money under the mattress, probably hasn't been the best the best thing to do. But actually, I think that what kind of shocked me about that was just how little the difference is between having the money in instant access and having it earning nothing at all. So you can see why a lot of people were just shunning saving and just thinking, what's the point? Which is something that we always talked about and always have talked about. Now, they don't, I think this is a more accurate and more of a, we always talk about the longer term and thinking things over the longer term. So over the last decade, we've got them to crunch the same figures. So a global equity fund, 132.6% before inflation, adjusted for inflation, 77.1%. That's a return on £10,000 of £17,705. So that's a nice return. That shows you that long-term investing, pretty good. The same for a UK equity income fund, 68%, adjusted for inflation, 27.9%. In real returns, that would mean £12,786. So not as good as being in a global equity fund, but still not a bad thing to do. Now, if we flip it into, and we'll talk about property here as well. So property, 71.5%, adjusted for inflation, that's 30.5%, a real return of £13,049. So a £3,000 bump, basically, if you had it in property over the last decade. Now, going back to the instant access, we've used a figure of 5.2%, which I think is pretty big, but you got to remember a decade ago there were some rates floating around that were fairly high, and we've had some rates floating around recently that are pretty high, but that does sound like a high amount to me. But even so, it's actually a return of minus 19.9% when adjusted for inflation, which would be now £10,000 would be worth £8,010, which is pretty mad. That's on 5%, 5.2%. If you had it just 0%, just 10 grand, minus 23.9, that's worth £7,611. So what this data that Ed got crunched from AJ Bell shows is just how much inflation can ravage basically your money, and depending on what you do with it. And we always talk here, a lot of people are obviously nervous about investing. You know, you see those celebrity interviews as well, and it's like property or pension. Well, it says property. Well, I tell you what, property hasn't been a bad bet, to be quite frank with you. But if you really wanted to make the returns, it's all about investing. And it shows you here over that decade long period, just how valuable it can be and how difficult it is to beat inflation outside of property and investing. It's incredibly difficult.
Simon, your views on this?
There are a number of studies. Two of the biggest ones are the Barclays Equity Gilt Study and the Credit Suisse Yearbook. Ignore Credit Suisse having to be rescued a few months back. The Credit Suisse Yearbook is a pretty solid publication. And they show that if you want the best chance of beating inflation over the long term, then investing is the way to do it. And you know, they look at various time periods, shorter, longer, and so on. And the longer you go, the more likely you are to make a real return, the more likely investing is to deliver the best return, and also the more likely you are to not lose money. But you have to be aware that these studies look at the performance of stock markets. If you invest in that stock market, even if you use a tracker fund, you will lose a little bit to the cost of the fund. And also, a lot of investors manage to underperform markets because they don't just buy a tracker fund. They try to go for active managers who they think will beat the market. They pick shares themselves they think will beat the market. And so that they run the risk of not doing as well. They might do better, but they run the risk of not doing as well. And also, investors have a tendency to, instead of buying low and selling high, they tend to do the opposite, and they try to do market timing, and they manage to underperform their own funds as well. They don't just underperform the market, they often underperform the actual investments that they hold. So think long term, be careful about what you invest in, and before you buy any investment, hold it up and Marie Kondo it. And instead of asking, does it bring me joy, ask, does it do anything that a cheap, simple global tracker fund wouldn't do instead?
Indeed. Good advice there, Simon. Meanwhile, you might be losing money through inflation, but the banks have been somewhat raking it in. Profits looking rather healthy. So Nationwide, just heard this morning, wants to give you some of that money back. Simon, just briefly, what's this about?
This is about Nationwide Building Society revealing its annual results, and it made a stonking £2.2 billion in pre-tax profit, up 38% on last year, as it basically cashes in while interest rates rise, which enables it to make more money. However, Nationwide is a building society, so it is owned by its members. And that means that its profits should go back into delivering better deals for its members, better savings rates, better mortgage rates, and so on. And to an extent, this is true. Many Nationwide members would grumble that they don't see as much of it as they think they should do in terms of that. Nationwide has a slightly tricky position, though, in being the biggest building society. If it offers a really, really cracking savings rate, then it faces a massive rush of people taking it out. However, as a Nationwide member of many years, I do not necessarily believe that many of the savings products it has offered me over the past two decades have fully reflected the amount of money that Nationwide has made, and it being a kind of on your side, we're delivering you a better deal. But I then do also realize that it has a lot of customers. However, its latest wheeze is to give all of its qualifying members £100. Woohoo!
Yeah.
So basically, if you are a Nationwide member and you meet the eligibility criteria, which is that you must either have a current account and a savings product or a current account and a mortgage product, then you will be bunged £100. And the qualifying things are current accounts. Your account must have been open on the 31st of March 2023, and you must still have a current account in June. Savings. You will have had qualifying savings if you had at least £100 in total in one or more personal savings accounts or cash ISAs with Nationwide at the end of any day in March 2023. And mortgage, to be a qualifying mortgage customer, you must owe at least £100 on your Nationwide residential mortgage on the 31st of March 2023. They announced it this morning. Members are getting emails in their inbox this morning offering them £100 from us as part of Nationwide's fairer share. So there you go. That's great. I tell you who's going to get a lot more than £100 though. Nationwide's chief executive, Debbie Crosby.
Yeah,
that's one of the other things Nationwide has been criticized for over the years. The amount of money that its executives get paid. I mean, we're talking big, big cheese, much more than £100.
Yeah, but you know, £100, better than a smack in the face with a wet fish.
And we couldn't all run Nationwide Building Society. So
yeah,
there you go.
Exactly.
I mean, they could rotate it around. Here's a question. If Nationwide rotated the chief executorship around all of its members and then divided up the salary and paid them it, would they get more or less than £100? I think it's probably less, actually.
Possibly. Talking of fish, though, moving on. Finally, food prices near record highs, cost up by over 19% in 1 year alone. Savvy shoppers, as we know, have been doing all sorts of things to bring down the price of their weekly shop, but how far would you go? Well, This Is Money have tested two apps that buy up food that's close to or past its best before date or has slightly damaged packaging and sell it on to us for a big discount compared to what we normally pay in the shops. Lee, tell me about the apps. Good idea?
Not a bad idea. I wouldn't recommend buying two-year-old fish, though. No. Potentially in a tin, but even then, I'm not sure. So basically, there's a few of these sort of websites that have cropped up where you can go and buy discounted food, basically stuff that's gone past expiration date, which is something that's been sort of hot in the press, in the news the last couple of years. The supermarkets have been scrapping dates and things like fruit and veg and all of that kind of stuff in a bid to cut down waste. We waste a lot in this country. We throw away a lot of food. We're guilty of it. We're guilty of throwing away all sorts of produce that basically we should have eaten and probably shouldn't have bought in the first place. So while we talk about food inflation being at 19%, I think that a lot of people probably have become a bit savvier in that regard and trying not to bin as much as what they're going through. So two of these websites that our reporter Sam Barker had a look at, one of them is called Matatoes, which is a bit of a strange name.
I'm glad you said that. I didn't want to say it because I wasn't quite sure how you pronounce it.
Well, it's like potatoes, but with an M. Matatoes.
All right.
Which I get targeted adverts for quite frequently.
Do you?
So you've got quite a big, they know me. They know that I'm after a bargain. They know that I'll eat anything and that I don't really care about Best Buy dates. I'll just do it. So that's probably why I'm probably their target audience, I would suggest. So what Sam did is he bought a kind of box of discounted goods, and some of these are, you know, gone fairly past their expiration date. Sam says he liked it, and there was plenty of food in there that was absolutely fine. One of the big things to watch out for on this, though, and one of the things I'm skeptical about these websites is the discounts that they kind of highlight, because there's that tendency to kind of highlight the discount versus the highest place you can find it. So a box of
RRPs
cereal.
And all that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you're a savvy shopper anyway, and you kind of know your price points, you know, you'll be fine. And actually, as Sam says in this, for example, he bought a pack of Shreddies, you know, absolute breakfast staple, but a box of Shreddies, £1.80. Matatoes called it a 42% discount on the normal retail price of £3.10. But he's found it for £2.79 in Iceland, £2.46 if you buy it off Amazon. So still a discount, but not as big a discount as what they're advertising on the website. So you have to bear that in mind when and if you are tempted by one of these. The other one that he used is called Approved Food. So Matatoes came without a delivery fee, which is sometimes, I think, some type of thing that puts people off. But if it's free, which it was for his order over £40, you know, you might be more likely to do it. Approved Foods, it was a £3 delivery fee. They're very similar, to be honest. Lots of canned goods and lots of stuff to basically snap up that, you know, are past their Best Buy dates, but you're going to save money on. The thing I would say about that, though, is that how many of us have old tins of beans and tomatoes and stuff floating around in the cupboards already? I mean, I'm not sure how much cupboard items people really need to stock up on. I mean, I'm talking about myself here. I find stuff floating around inside cupboards from years ago. And I'm going to be totally frank with you here, Georgie. We throw hardly anything away in this house. There is no Best Buy dates. I caught my wife giving my daughter like six week out of date yogurt the other day.
Oh, my word.
She said, I'd be fine.
Oh, I draw the line at dairy or meat.
Did a sniff test. You know, is it okay? Brooke tried it. She was like, yeah, it's fine. We're all alive. We're all fine. You know, I draw the line at certain things. You know, I'm never going to eat things like off meat. But, you know, I even find things like milk now. Milk lasts. It feels like it lasts forever. Does it ever go off anymore? What are they pumping into it? I mean, honestly, I sometimes open a carton and it goes on for about 10 days. I don't remember that. So, you know, it depends on your lifestyle. It depends on your house. The other thing also I would say is if you go, I am not adverse to going shopping somewhere like Poundland. Listen, I mean, I still love sniffing out a bargain. I don't care. We've got a great Poundland up in Rayleigh High Street. I go up in there. A lot of the food and things that they sell in there, is close to best buy date. They can't get away with selling things that have gone over. But you have to know your price points, because there are things and items in there that are more expensive than you can get them in the supermarket, especially if you go into a supermarket and you find things that are on discount and that kind of thing. But I'm having a real love-hate relationship with supermarkets at the moment, Georgie. I'm annoyed that I have to go into Tesco and Sainsbury's now and have to use a loyalty card in order to get the best price. It really annoys me. I think that's driven me to go to Aldi and Lidl even more, because I don't have to muck around. I don't want to do all this loyalty stuff and data and all that kind of thing. So, you know, there's lots of things. There's a lot of people out there that I think, especially this new world, that get food deliveries, for example, from some of the big supermarkets. So Tesco, Sainsbury's, all of these, got Ocado, they all have these passes that you can use over the course of the year. Relatively good value, to be honest. I think they start from about £40 for the year to get unlimited food deliveries to your door. I think a lot of people do repeat orders and all that kind of thing now. I think with the food inflation stuff, people know their price point. So all of a sudden, if they see a jar of coffee that they've been buying for the last 5 years and it's cost £4.50, and now all of a sudden it's £6.50, they ain't having it. And they just switch brand. And I think there's a lot of people out there at the moment doing that kind of thing. If you are someone like this, these two websites might be for you. It's worth having a fish around, seeing what's on there. You're not going to be able to do your weekly shop on there, because there's things that clearly that it's not going to have. Things like fruit and vegetables, support your local greengrocer, support your local butcher. That's what I would say. There's no such thing as best buy dates on fruit and veg. You know when it's gone off. It just doesn't look good, and it doesn't taste right, and it doesn't smell right. So you just get rid of it. So for that reason, Georgie, as I would say in Dragon's Den, I'm out.
Marvellous. Marvellously. Honestly, we've missed you. We've missed you. Right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, 6-week-old yogurt. Simon?
Don't look too closely into a 6-week-old yogurt unless you like the mould staring back at you. You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. Come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. Find all podcasts past. Join in the debate. Read comments. Have your say in our poll, or tell us how much you hate inheritance tax, or how it should be whacked up to 100% and we should squeeze the rich till the pips squeak.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.